Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about, let's see, have this trigger, sort of the specter pattern, and we used this in the context of information leaking through the cache. So our pattern that we were using was we do this prime step where we filled up a cache, we ran some interesting code, and then we did this probe step where we looked at what running that interesting code evicted from the cache. And sometimes, if the code runs just normally, that gives us useful information. We saw the example with like encryption algorithms that do table lookups. That information tells us where the table lookups were to some extent. That's useful by itself. But what makes this a very powerful technique is how it interacts with out-of-order processors. And kind of the fundamental issue here is that out-of-order processors run things speculatively. We learned that when we learned about branch prediction, that we had this neat idea that we could guess what code to run and just start running it right away before we confirmed that that guess was correct. And this was fine because we would undo those guesses before we went back to the normal program. But the problem is that we don't actually completely undo them in a typical out-of-order processor, that there's some side effects of the code we executed speculatively that are still visible afterwards. And one example, the example we exploited in our examples, but not the only thing we could do, is the cache changes. So even though that code gets undone, we don't completely undo its accesses to the cache, which need to evict things, because that's how the cache works, right? When you read from the cache, it actually modifies stuff in the cache. And so we can confer what happened after, you know, some code executed speculatively. And this meant that we could bypass all sorts of things that you might assume keep an attacker from doing something. And the sort of classic example we saw with Spectre was a bounce check, that we have some code that did that had this pattern where we did this kind of nested array access. And we saw that, you know, it might not be written out as an array, nested array access, but we got this effect somehow. And the branch prediction would skip any bounce check on that array access because, well, usually if we have an if statement that says if this is less than the size, well, that's usually true if we have an array access. So it's going to be predicted as, well, let's try to run that because almost all the time that's the right thing for the processor to do. And if we go out of bounds, we can make the access to the array B read anything. We just choose an X, we do some math to figure out what value of X, when we add it to the base address of B and multiply by the size of array elements, gives us the location in memory we want, and we can get pretty much anywhere in memory modulo, we know how big array elements are. And then we have this second access that kind of lets us read out the value we read for B. So while the processor is executing this code that's going to be undone, it can get far enough to actually read B of X. And it can get far enough to use B of X to start accessing A. And that's what we're going to take advantage of, that it starts accessing A. We see that it's going to evict something from the cache to do that access if the cache is full. And we can arrange for that to happen with this prime plus probe strategy and also figure out where exactly was evicted. And that's going to learn, no, it's going to give us something about the value of B of X. In particular, it's going to give us the index bits of the address computed for A of B of X, and we can work backwards to sort of look, do some algebra to solve for B of X. We won't probably get the whole thing, but we'll get some part of it. Some questions about what we covered last time. And based on my preliminary look at the quiz results, we probably should go through quiz questions 4, 5, and 6. So quiz question 4 was saying, we were doing this prime plus probe strategy and was asking, well, what information did we actually learn from the probe? And in particular, It was asking you to express that in terms of, does that information distinguish between these two values? And well, the information we actually learn was kind of these 7 bits of the address, because we learned the index bits. We learned what set was evicted. That's determined by the index bits in this example of a pointer access. And we can figure out exactly where those index bits are in the pointer, and I just look at my pair of pointers for each option and say, do those actually differ in the index bits? If the answer is yes, then knowing that the index bits are, you know, 0001000 will tell us which one. If they're the same, it won't tell us anything. We'll confirm it's one of the two, and that's it. Questions about question 4? Yes?
Say the index bits are the same, but they have a different tag. Is there a chance that that one of them would evict what's in that spot, and one wouldn't? Thus, you'd be able to tell it's the right value only if the tag matches?
So the question is, let's say, we know they can differ in the tag. Would that let us tell? So I'm assuming here, which I didn't state explicitly in the problem, but given that we aren't taking a pointer to the array, that the pointer doesn't point to the array, because that would be the only case where that would be different. So for the tag to match in our prime plus probe strategy, right, we filled the array with our array, filled the cache with our array, all the tags are our array tags. So if something's not evicted, it would only be because it was a pointer to the array somehow, which doesn't seem possible with that code I have there. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How do we know? So this question didn't specify where the base of the array was. So what if it has specified a base, would that have changed what some of the answers had?
So question is, the question didn't specify what the base address of the array was. Does that affect the answer? And the answer is no, because if we think of the array indices, like they're going to cover all the possible index values. If we go from the array from 0 to 4095, it's going to cover all the possible index values at least once. Possibly it's going to cover one twice.
As in, like, if something was 10 away, like 10, could a cache barrier be between those two if the offset of the array is set up like that?
If something is 10 away, what do you mean 10 away?
10 bits, 10 bytes away, because there are 32 bytes, the cache size is 32, so could if something was 10 bytes away from another value, would, or I guess, sorry, OX10, 32, would that mean that you could be across that line, or no, 16, sorry, across that, like, cache set?
So the question is, could things in the array kind of be unevenly distributed across the cache blocks? And the answer is absolutely yes, but that doesn't affect this option in a meaningful way, because regardless of what they are, sort of in the array, you know, let's say we start at some address and that has like an index and a tag, index and an offset that are not zeros, you know, so we start at offset 110111011111, then the array is going to go all the way up to an all ones and then offset and index, and then to an all zeros, and then all the way back around to just before this. And in that process, we're going to cover all the possible indexes. So there's somewhere we can look in the array to probe that will have been evicted from whatever index is accessed. It doesn't matter what it is. Now, that the base address would affect where we went to probe in the array to figure that out, but that wasn't part of the question. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, why are we looking at these specific, getting these specific bits?
Yeah, why are we looking at
what versus other bits. So these are this is the bits the cache kind of gives us naturally. Because if we think of this value in the cache is stored in the same cache block as, say, this value, right? The one at an address one greater, right? Because that only differs in the offset bits. And the same is true if I set these offset bits to anything else. So So I'm never going to learn anything about these last five bits because they're the offset bits, and all I'm learning is that a whole cache block was changed or not. I'm not learning about anything with a smaller granularity. So those last five bits are out of the question. Then we have the tag bits, and I don't learn about those with this prime first probe technique because all I can do is figure out that what was evicted, and the evictions are going to be based on the replacement policy and what set we went to. And the set is determined only by this stuff here. The rest of the thing doesn't matter for the set. The replacement policy, like, yes, it might have to choose in some cases. In this case, it doesn't have even have a choice. It's direct map. There's only one thing. But even if there was a replacement policy, the replacement policy is not going to be like based on the tag, right, of what you're accessing. It's going to be based on like what's already in the cache, not what the new access was. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, and let's do question 5 and 6. So if we're doing our spectre style attack in this scenario, our goal is that the bounds check is mispredicted. That means that the table of X access sensitive data and puts it in the result variable, and then the second access is going to leak information about the value of result. So that means that if we're choosing the value of X, we want to make that table of X access our sensitive data. So I figure out what's the address of table of X based on how we compute array accesses and solve for X with our desired address. So then we had question 6, which was saying, okay, let's say we've learned what cache sets are evicted in this case. And in fact, I learned it with two different Y values, which is lets me sort of really narrow down the possible values of our interesting value, which I've labeled as secret in here. And what we've been told, given the Y values, is that the address of table with secret plus 15 mod 256 has index bits equal to 2. And if we do plus 16, it has index bits equal to 3. And if we look, since we know that the difference between these two addresses is 1, because that's the size of an element of table, we can actually figure out all the offset bits from this, right? The offset bits must sort of roll over for the index bits to go increment by 1 with this addition of 1. So they have to be all 1s, sort of our maximum value for the plus 15, and then all 0s for plus 16 value, since we just tweaked as little as possible and sort of rolled over to the next index. So we must be at the beginning of the values with that index. So then I can solve for this case. So we know that this table plus 16 mod 256 value, this is sort of the address that we're going to have for that array access. It has this form, right? We have some unknown tag, we have an index of 3, and an offset of 0. So this is our offset, this is our index bits with how the cache works. So I know the address has that form. And I just want to work backwards to figure out what secret plus 256 is. So I have the address has this form. I just copy this down to here. And I know the address of table. And I just need to solve this to figure out what's the address of secret plus 16 mod 256. And I figure out that it has the same bit pattern as it turns out to make that addition work out. We can also actually figure out that all the remaining bits are zeros because mod 256 has to give something that's smaller than 256. But we don't actually need to know that. And so then I went to figure out a specific value for secret, and I can just figure out something I can put in the question marks, which zeros works, and say, okay, so secret plus 16 could be, if we assume 256 OXC0, which is, this is C here, if we write it as a hex digit, and if I solve by subtracting 16, I get secret is OXB0 or 176. And there are some other possible values too, because we have that mod 256 operation, so there's actually a whole bunch of different possible values, but this is one of them. Questions? Yeah?
Were we not allowed to
put the answer? You were. As it says on the quiz, not all answers will be graded automatically. And I put like all the possible, well not all, I put most of the possible decimal answers in the key, but I neglected to put most of the possible hexadecimal answers in the key. Other questions? Okay. So, that gives us to okay, so that gets us, and I want to do here to there. Okay, so as I mentioned last time, we're going to do exam review, and I'm going to go over the things you want me to go over, and if there's nothing for me to go over, we'll just be done early. So what do you want me to go over? I'm going to collect a list of topics. I'm not going to go over each right away. I'm going to sort them, and then we'll go through them and see how many times we can do that. So, yes. Caches, okay. Anything more specific?
The difference between tag and index bits, and also, I guess, how they work on the macro scale, and also how the whole business, like the four-way set.
Okay, so tag versus tag, index, tag bits, and index bits. So overall organization and multi-way. Okay. Yes, back there. Okay. Okay. So yeah.
Can you go over pipeline latency and pipeline stage timing?
Quiz for week 9, which is question 3, which is cash. Okay. There we go. Yes. Okay. Anything more specific? So, exception handling. How does the OS know what to do? OS code work. Okay. Way back there. Okay, so why DH versus normal asymmetric? Okay. And front, yeah. Why are write policies useful? Anything more specific?
I don't understand the difference between like which layers go for which protocols and how they're different.
Okay. So layers, which protocols map to which layers? Anything more specific?
Like how like symmetric or symmetric and how packages will get into that.
Okay. And sort of what can attacker do with asymmetric versus symmetric? Okay. Spring 2023 Q6, which is on Christian, okay. Which one is what? Okay. We'll just that's what I think already covered. Okay. Certificates. So understanding sort of counting processes with fork, wait PID, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Could you talk about broadcasting?
In the context of pthreadcon broadcast?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry?
For the system call and exception stuff, can you also go over what causes the
content? Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over the structure of network packets and how they change when they go through the nodes?
Okay. Anything, any specific question? Okay, so I think that seems like a reasonable start. So what's difficult? I am always surprised about what students end up scoring poorly on the final. What's important? So I went through the schedule page and compared number of lectures on topic to number of points on topic on the final drafts. Like, they're not gonna match exactly, especially because like I don't want to ask a question which is just do the page table homework again. Do the lab again. That's what I look at. And my idea of what topic students find difficult, I'm always surprised. Why did everyone fail this virtual memory question and get this what I thought was harder question, right? Yeah. happens. But as far as what topics are covered, like, that's how I made the exam, like, checked what's on the exam and made sure I wasn't, like, annoyed by it. And obviously, like, not everything gets covered because I'm trying to not fill all 3 hours. I know many of you will stay for all 3 hours. My hope is to have, like, half the people gone in 2 hours. We'll see if that actually happens. Okay, so system calls and exception handling. So, how does the OS code work? So, the OS sets up exception handlers, which are run by the processor. There's a different handler for each event that can trigger an exception. So, you have different things that trigger exceptions. The OS can have different handlers for that. Which means the OS, so the OS code can use what triggered it to decide what to do. But fundamentally, the OS code is running. The OS code gets to decide what to do. If the OS code likes, it can do a context switch, meaning it sort of saves the current program or thread and loads a different program or thread. So note that this is not triggered by the exception inherently. It's because the OS has a handler for that event that does that. And I guess I probably should say, what triggers the exception? So events, so hardware triggers, you know, runs exception handlers in response to, you know, I/O devices asking for attention. Instructions, programs are running that it can't handle itself. Yes?
Is this file going to be posted?
Is this file going to be posted? Yes. So as for when does a context switch happen, it happens when the OS code does it in an exception handler. And the OS code can just choose to do it whenever it's written to, right? They can write whatever if statements they like. As for inferring when it happens, you know, you can infer a context switch must have happened if we are running a different program than we were before. Or than before. I think that takes care of. So timers. So OSs want to prevent infinite loops from hogging a core. So hardware exposes a sort of timer device. And you can kind of think of, you know, device, you know, same idea, device like a keyboard device. Like a keyboard device as, you know, in how it talks to the CPU, the OS can set an alarm on this timer that will trigger an exception that runs the OS, and the OS does whatever it wants to do, typically not keep running a program forever. But as far as the interface to the processor, like, it's kind of like it's an external device like a keyboard, except instead of happening when some human presses a key, the OS configures an alarm to go off, and when it goes off, it's like the alarm's pressing a key. Okay. Yes? Does an exception always trigger a context switch? No. The OS has to write code to do it, and that code can never context switch if it wants to. Whether that's useful for your system, maybe not, but like if the OS wants to only run one program, it can never context. It could just not context switch, and it will only run one program. Yeah? Question about whether running a signal handler is a context switch. So are signal handlers context switches? So signal handlers run in an existing program slash thread. Kind of like a function call that's done by the OS instead of by the program. So if we're already running that thread, no need for, no context switch, just the work for the funny function call. We obviously would need to context switch to be running it. Yeah. Is it possible to turn off the lights on the screen? That is not a question I have a fast answer to.
It's going to be white podium. No, the light switch for the room will be next to the button.
A white panel at the podium. It tells us. Okay. White panel.
Was that next where you turned on the projector?
Oh, right. Yes. I was looking. White panel at the podium. Is that... That is, okay. Yay, okay. Okay. There we go. Now that is more readable. Okay. So, yes.
Sorry, just to clarify, would a kill signal handler cause a context switch if you're sending a kill to another process?
Question, would a kill signal handler cause a context switch? So, something needs to run that signal handler. Note that kill doesn't necessarily run it immediately. As I said, it can wait. So if we have a single core, then we need a context switch to run it. If we don't have a single core, right, it could just run on another core that's maybe already running the program. Yeah?
Context switch only applies to processes, right? So it can't really
come. Question, context switch only applies to processes? We use the term context switch for switching threads, regardless of whether we're switching processes at the same time, too. If we have two threads in a different process, there you go. So I'll write sort of context switches. So kill might not run signal handler immediately. So kill does not imply context switch, even if in other process. And context switch includes switching any type of switching threads. Obviously, if we say process context switch, we don't mean just switching threads, regardless of whether in the same process. Okay, so then, yeah.
Now what's an example of a thread context switch that would occur that would not be a process context switch?
What is an example of a thread context switch that would occur and not be a process context switch? So if we pthread create a thread and then pthread join it, that thread has to run for us to pthread join to return, so there must be a context switch somewhere in there. Assuming we're on a single core. If we're on multiple cores, that might not be enough. Yeah. So the first part of the question, is this a comprehensive list of all the types of context switches we have? So context switches are changing threads. Exceptions are not the same thing. So a context switch is something that OSs do sometimes. The reason we confuse them with context switches is that when do OSs run? When there's exceptions. As for causes of exceptions, this is almost in a comprehensive list. I also am missing sort of something is wrong in the hardware is probably the only other cause I missed. By wrong, I mean your memory is broken. And those are the types of events. And note that IO devices, that's very broad, I'm including timers in that. And very other things that you might not consider traditional IO devices. The program running something that can't be handled, that's like seg faults and system calls, both are examples of that.
And what's the general name of seg faults again? There's a general name for, is exceptions that general name, and then there are the interrupts a default.
So the question is, we have specific names for types of exceptions. We are not going to test on that because, as I mentioned, they vary depending on who you're reading. But the names you'll typically see are interrupts, faults, and traps. And broadly intentional versions of these system calls are traps, intentionally triggered exceptions, basically. Interrupts are usually these I/O devices, and faults are usually the name for things that are like out of bounds memory access. And this you might sometimes see the term abort, but as I said, the terminology varies. We're not going to test on it because I don't want to punish you for actually knowing real terms that are just used elsewhere. Yeah. So the question is, the process is reading something from a disk, and it tries to, what did you say?
It tries to read the same thing again.
In the simplest case, we'd assume, if it's actually going to access the disk, that has to go through the OS, and the OS has to know about it, so we probably have a system call to let the OS know about that request. Question? Question, is it possible to send a kill signal to a specific thread? Yes. We did not talk about this, but yes, it is. There's a function called pthreadkill to do that. And on Linux, it turns out that there are thread IDs that are separate from process IDs. And there's a version of kill which will deal with those, but that's not portable. Okay, so then we have counting processes with fork, wait, PID, etc. So my recommendation is to draw a diagram, you know, sort of showing things split up. So I sort of draw these diagrams where we like say a process is running and we have a fork, and I kind of represent vertical lines that show our threads. And we have an example here where we fork, say, twice. With my prompt two. And let's say I know we wait here. Well, I can say the waiting, right, whatever happens after the waiting, will kind of have us on, and then I can kind of draw a diagram like this. So for example, in this case, you know, this would correspond to, you know, something like forking, and if we're in the child, forking again. And if we're in that other child, we do something. Otherwise, let's say we exit. And in the parent, right, this would be a diagram of what happens there. And we can sort of read this diagram and say, okay, we have a way of having three things happening at once. Like, it's possible that, like, we wait before this process gets running. And also, we see that there's no constraint between here. So I only drew this as sort of executing until here, but, you know, there's nothing that says it doesn't keep going. So I know at the end, I can have up to two processes running after the wait. Right. So the important thing about the diagram is like not that you can't just blindly like go across and say, oh, there's two things running, but you can say, oh, is there any dependency that keeps something from these sort of stretching down? Because you can mark with sort of your picture all the sort of fork and waits that sort of consolidate and unconsolidate processes.
And that's my recommendation for sort of working through that. And you can also do something similar for the same question with like P3 create and P3 join. Questions? Okay. Then we have caches. So our first was on tagging index bits. So our basic cache operation, so the sort of cache lookup process, is that we split an address into tag, index, offset. And we use the index to access a set, which is a row in the way we typically drop in the cache. And that set contains some number, let's say k sort of blocks. Each block is either invalid and doesn't have anything, or is valid and we need to know where it came from. And to know where it came from, and we know where it came from using the tag. And if it's valid, it contains tag index 0000, it values from, through tag index and all ones for the offset. It contains values for all the possible offsets with that tag and index. So the question is, so it's stored and, so I guess we'll go metadata, so we're coming from using the tag, so, which is yes, so the tag is stored metadata, and we also have, I guess I should write, so each block needs to have metadata, which is going to be a valid bit, to say invalid or not, a tag to say where it came from, and sometimes we'll have a dirty bit, if we need to remember whether to write this later, we'll have LRU, or we'll have replacement policy information, since I'm going to be more generic information, so which would be LRU information. If our replacement policy is LRU, it would be something else if we have a different replacement policy. And I don't think we talked about other metadata, but we could imagine extending the cache. So we find either, if we find a valid block whose tag matches, we have a hit, we extract the part of the block corresponding to the offset. Otherwise, we add a new block to the cache, possibly replacing something needed, and return the correct part of that block. I guess this is cache lookup on read, since we were asked about writes. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah?
Sorry, can I explain the concept of dirty bits real quick?
Can I explain the concept of dirty bits? We're going to go over write policies, and we'll do that then. First, questions on the sort of read side. Okay, so that, I think, is tag bits and index bits, and I think overall organization. So multi-way just means that we have, just means multiple blocks in a set, and we just have some extra work to do. So we need to, check all of them on, you know, to see if something's in the cache, we need to choose which one to replace, you know, when adding something, you know, since they're a fixed number, you know. And we, yeah, I guess that does, so that, those are our decisions with multiple ways, which we don't have with a direct map of one-way cache. Yes, question.
If a set has 64-byte blocks, when we go to replace one of this, we replace the entire block.
So question, if we have 64-byte blocks, do we have to, do, when we go on a miss, do we replace the entire block? Yes, so we block and we always add a full, add full blocks. We have no shortcuts. If we wanted to store smaller bits of data, we need more metadata to remember where that came from. All we have is a single set of tag bits and a valid bit that can only tell us we have, if we have a 64-byte block size, 64 bytes. It can't tell us we have 32 bytes from one place and 32 bytes from another. Yeah.
So, if some question says the cache is 32 kilobytes and it's two ways, does that mean each way is 16 kilobytes?
If some question says that the cache is 32 kilobytes and it's two ways, does that mean that each way is 16 kilobytes? So, 32 kilobyte two way means that we have, you know, 16 kilobytes of blocks per way, but, you know, still don't know, but need more info to know size of each block. Yeah. Will we test it on multi-level? We can ask about it, right. That was what was overall organization was probably asking about, so we'll talk about that. So, often, typically we have sort of the processor talks to an L1 data cache and an L1 instruction cache, and these talk to typically in a shared, I guess we'll do this way, a shared L2 cache, and this might talk to a shared L3 cache that is also talked to by other cores, other CPUs, and sort of with multiple levels, accesses that miss in L1 go to L2. Miss in L2 goes to L3. And sort of our goal is to lower the time to bring values into the lower caches. Yes? We will do a second pass after we go through this first set of stuff. If we have time, which we'll find out. Okay, it's multi-way. Okay, and write policies. So why are write policies useful? So the cache lookup on write is going to be very similar to the cache lookup on read. So, in fact, the first two steps are the same. We look for a set, we check the tags, if we have a valid thing that matches, we have a hit. And on a hit, we definitely need to modify the sort of data in the cache to match the write. And we have an option. And this option is known as write back, So one option is called write back, and that's mark the data as dirty and update the next level / memory later. So we just update the cache in the write back option. And we have a second option, which is write through, which is update the next level memory now. And sort of why would we choose either of these? So the write back option means fewer next level slash memory accesses. Right? We're just not doing it as often as we would before, you know, especially if a value is modified a lot before it's done being used. And the write through is less bookkeeping, and no work later on. Don't have to, you know, write back the value later on when it might be less convenient. Yes?
Is write allocate another option?
So we haven't gotten to write allocate yet. So we will talk about that option in a bit. But that is not an option in this choice. This choice, right out, there's a right back, right through. Those are our options. We haven't, don't have any others. None that we've talked about. Okay, so that's on a hint. So if we have a miss, we have options here, unlike in our read case. So we have the write allocate option, which is add the new block to the cache, replacing something if needed. Is our, again, we always add full blocks. And if so, if adding update value in cache, and, you know, go to sort of, I guess the option sort of, go to option ** to decide what to do about next level. So that's the write allocate option, is that we add it to the cache and then we go back to our normal procedure for a hit to figure out what do we do about the next level in memory, do we update it right away or not. And then we have separately, we have the write allocate option, which is do not add new block, just update next level plus memory. And as far as why would we choose these, so this option, sort of, this is, you know, good idea if we're going to modify or read this value soon. Which is what we expect from locality. And this is a good idea if we're not going to do that, which some, you know, does happen like a bit, because, you know, often we'll like be setting something to all zeros, right, and not reading it for a while. Questions on that? And okay, so now I get to pull up a quiz. So quiz 9, quiz for week 9, which is not quiz 9, I was confused for a bit, question 3. And this was at saying, so this question, we had a cache with, we had 16 byte cache blocks and 256 sets, which means we have 4 offset bits, 8 index bits, and we had an array of 4 byte integers and array 100 at arx 0, and array 100 could evict something from array 100, then array x accessed, and access to array x evicted array 100. So this is actually like a preview of our prime first probe example, in that what do we know about if array x evicts array 100? They have the same index bits. So array 100 and array x need to have the same index bits. So we're going to say that And in fact, we can compute what the index bits are for array 100. And so we're going to sort of solve array of 100 times 4, you know, size of int, you know, the index bits of equals the index bits of array plus x times the size of int. And how can we do this? Well, if we do out kind of our math, we have, let's, you know, so let's say the index, do we actually have it written in the answer? No. But let's say the index is 44, then we know that we have 00 and that array 100 equals that 44, which is not correct, but do you, well, say index 44, then we have that, and we want to say array of x is going to have the same pattern. You know, so then choose some value for the questions in array of x, and then work backwards, then solve array plus x times size of int equals the value with the questions filled. That's sort of the pattern for solving that problem, is that it's very similar to that example, to sort of what we've been doing with sort of Spectre, because it's the same problem. We want to figure out, what do we know about an address that was evicted? And the way we could say is that we know the index bits are fixed, and we can just say, okay, so we can think of some possibilities for the other bits, choose one of them, and then figure out, how do I work backwards to figure out that's array of x for what x? And that's going to be just solving sort of a simple algebra once we have a like complete number, because our array access is this array plus x times size of int, which is 4 in this case, equals that address. Questions? Okay, so then TLBs and the relationship to page tables. So normal page table lookup is sort of, you know, I guess I'll say K-level page table lookup is we take the virtual address and divide into K a virtual page number, which is further divided into K parts, and an offset, we look up part one of the virtual page number in the page table at PTBR. We use the lookup part two of the virtual page number in a page table we find using previous lookup. And the same, we just repeat this process up to k plus 1. Then we compute the address, final physical address using result of each of these lookups. Then we compute the final physical address using the virtual page number from previous lookup result and the physical page number from the previous lookup result and the offset from the original address. So with TLBs, well, when TLBs on a hit, skip steps 2 through k plus 1. Just do all of that. So step 1 is sort of take virtual address and divide, and we have kind of step 1a is look up virtual page number, the whole thing, in TLB. And then we skip steps on hit, skip a lot of steps, and do k plus 2. We're just going to be using from TLB lookup result. So on a hit, that's what the TLB does, right? It just skips that entire process. And to do that, we take in the entire virtual page number as inputs. And TLB is on a miss, we sort of add a step to fill in the TLB. So we are going to have a k plus 2a, right? Sort of an extra step, which is going to be, or k plus 1a, we'll say, which is going to be add physical page number, virtual page number, physical page number plus other page table entry info to TLB. Questions on that? Okay, and we had week 6 quiz, but I would like something more specific than go over the whole quiz, because otherwise I'm probably going to guess what people want. What questions do people have trouble with here? Something, anyone have more, I think it was over here, more specific on the week 6 quiz?
Are you looking for the one with the lowest average
right now? I could look for that, but I'm not sure that actually matches what people are confused about. I think that would be the last question. So we'll do, unless people have something else to suggest. So question 6 says that we have 2 to the 16 byte pages. And multi-level page tables, and in fact, no, how many levels? I guess we can infer how many levels there are from the size of a virtual address. So with 8192 entries, 192, which is going to be 2 to the 13 entries per level, and we have 55-bit virtual addresses, which is going to be 55 bits is 16-bit offset plus k levels times 13 VPN bits per level. Why 13? So this is 13 bits, to look up an index in a table. So we can solve and find out that this gives us k equals 3, hopefully. And then we're told that we access the address here. And we're told sort of what happens at each step of the lookup. And we're asked what address was used for the second level of the lookup. And if we go back to our steps up here, the second level of the lookup used the first level result. So that's what we really care about here. And so sort of, so first I will divide this up into its parts. So I'll do step one of our lookup, which was to divide it up into parts. And that isn't, okay, it's barely appearing on the slide. So we have offset is going to be OX9ABC, since that's mits. And then we have 00, so we have 001, so we'll have, I'll go backwards, so we'll have 567, and part of, I guess 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, so this is 0001, 0. One. So that's our virtual page number, and we're going to divide it into 13-bit segments. So that's the first one. This is the second one. And the third one is all zeros. So, and we're told, want to find sort of address used for second level lookup, sort of was based on first level result of physical page 0x54. So physical page 0x54's addresses are 0x54000 through 0000 through 4, sort of all possible page offset. So that's where our page table, and this is the location of the second level page table. The index in the second level page table is this second VPN part here. So that, which we can rewrite. Which I won't bother rewriting, but there, and we're going to take that index sort of to, and the array lookup, sort of the page lookup is going to be 0x5400 plus index times size of entry. So it's going to be 0x5400 plus this index here times 8, because we're told they're our level, and because we were told in the information in the question that we have 8 by each table of entries. So this formula gives us our final answer then. Questions? And I see I am, okay, I'm not even close on time. Okay, so threads versus processes. So threads share memory, processes don't. That is basically the difference. In fact, like on Linux, like there's like one system call that creates threads or processes, it just differs in whether it shares memory. PthreadCon broadcast. So sort of PthreadCon wait is to wait, you know, adds thread to a list of waiters. Sometimes, you know, other threads can detect that some thread needs to stop waiting. So an example is, you know, if we know threads are waiting for a queue to be non-empty, we want to stop threads waiting when the queue becomes non-empty. Con broadcast lets all waiting threads stop waiting. You know, sort of it's an alternative. There's also signal, which only does one, you know, which if, you know, only does one, but you know, that's not always appropriate. Whether that's appropriate depends on the specifics of our scenario, but it's, you know, sort of, you know, always safe to use broadcast because waking up additional threads shouldn't matter since they need to, since they always double check whether they're ready when they run again. And I'll do my rushing through this. Network protocols and layers. Which protocols map to which layers? So we have kind of our link layer is local network only. We have our network layer is bridging between networks, but not handling reliability, identifying specific programs, and things like that. So that all is not handled at the network layer, but is handled at the transport layer. You know, handles reliability, streams of data, sending to specific programs, not just a machine. And the structure of packets is we'll have a link layer frame that contains a network layer packet, that contains a transport layer segment or datagram, that contains sort of application layer data. You know, the network layer routers will copy a packet from packet out of one frame and into a new frame when sending things, receiving on one network and sending on another. Okay, and then we have, definitely not finishing this properly, but why Diffie-Hellman versus normal asymmetric? Why do we do key agreement? So we can use normal asymmetric to do what Diffie-Hellman accomplishes. Sort of the main practical advantage is that it's easier to use temporary sort of secret values, private values, with DH than with asymmetric schemes. Faster, much faster. Generating keys for many asymmetric schemes is really slow, but Diffie-Hellman would just use a random value each time, and that's fast. And that's just because the math is different. Digital signatures and verification. So digital signatures, so we, you know, signature verifies that someone with the private key chose to run the sign operation. We run the verify operation to check it. And certificates are sort of are a way of distributing public keys. So, and the idea is, if we trust X, we want to let X give us other public keys. Certificates are a way of getting public keys from X, but without communicating directly. Instead, X generates a message with a signature we can verify that tells us about a public key, and someone who wants us to learn the public key, like whoever it's for, 4 sends us that message from X they got earlier. So certificates are just saving, letting us learn from someone about keys, but saving us directly communicating with them all the time. And then I think I'm rough. What can an attacker do with asymmetric versus symmetric? So with asymmetric, we assume everyone can do the operations with the public key. So we just need to, need to beware that, anyone can encrypt, and maybe don't need to beware, and anyone can verify signatures. And there's no inherent problem with this as long as we don't make assumptions that because something is encrypted, it came from a specific place. The problem is that sometimes we accidentally make that assumption, like you saw in the secure channels lab. And I will, for sake of time, so I'll do my brief latency and throughput. So latency, so if we have pipeline that does FD, EMW, and we just do that over again, and we have that here. Our latency is the time W is, end to end time. Our throughput is number of instructions divided by time. So in this example, we're going to have, so here we have, this is going to be sort of n overall. So in this example, if we that takes n time, we have sort of n minus 4 instructions done if that pattern continues in n time, which is approximately 1 cycle per instruction, sort of the ideal case without stalling, etc. Right, but we're measuring very different things there. And time for pipeline stages. So the cycle time is going to be the slowest stage plus sort of anything we added for pipelining, which is usually new registers. And the slowest stage, has to be, and when we're dividing a single cycle processor into k pieces, those pieces should take, 1k the time at least, unless we made our single cycle CPU poorly. Probably more than that. Okay, so that's everything but going through one quiz question. I'm already 5 minutes over time. Yes?
So for this line, when calculating the throughput, is it correct if I calculate the cycle number of the last stages right in this case minus the first instructions?
Is it right if I calculate the cycle number of the last stages right for a second? So it's overall instructions over time. So if you calculate the cycle number of the first versus the last, like that would be what we want to do. When we're calculating throughput in practice, we usually just say, look at the time between right stages finishing, because over a large program, that extra four cycles at the beginning doesn't matter. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
other ships. Yeah. So that is like the who's sending, why are we saying sending a message to the verifying? So the, like, if a web server wants to tell us about its public key, it's going to send us the message from the certificate authority, which is X. We are going to verify that later, but that's not what the web server cares about.
So like, why would I send a message?
You send that message because you know I can verify it. And therefore it's useful to me to have. But you aren't going to care about verifying that, you're just forwarding it. So that's, yeah. And I'll have office hours tomorrow, and yes, I'm over time.